What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Shuttle Drive. I'm your host, Wade Harrison, and today's video or podcast, whatever you want to call it, I have my buddy Floyd Miracle from where? Kentucky, the great state of Kentucky, right? Bluegrass state, born and raised. And Floyd, tell us a little about your background and yourself here, and we'll just go on from here.
Well, thanks for having me. Name's Floyd Miracle. I am a paramedic. My current job is training other paramedics. I perform quality assurance, remediation, stuff like that. I've been a paramedic for approximately 12 years. I've worked in a wilderness environment. I've been a flight paramedic. I've been a firefighter paramedic. And the coolest thing that I did was I worked as a paramedic on a movie set once. So that was a pretty cool gig.
Now, wait a minute. You're telling me being on a movie set is cooler than being a like a chopper paramedic? You were on a helicopter, right? I take it.
Yeah. I flew part-time with Air Evac for about, 7-8 months, but it is.
In a movie was cool. What's a movie? Can I look it up? Are you an extra somewhere?
Well, it's got my name at the very end, on the titles and stuff as a set medic, but I actually forgot the name, but let me find it.
Okay, just somewhere in the podcast,
Fire Down Below.
Fire Down Below. Man, that sounds like a... No, I'm not even going to go there. Never mind. I said I'd be more PG on my podcast. I know. No more cursing, no more innuendos. But what I like about having you on, Floyd, we had actually talked, a month ago or so, and you're actually also, you do training for paramedics. So you're the guy that trains the people that's probably saving our asses on the river or out of a paramedic, right?
Yeah, exactly. So like, I don't do generally initial education, but we get a lot of new paramedics that are brand new graduates. So we basically bring them from their program and I orient them to our system standards and kind of bring them up to speed. So I basically reteach them things that they should have learned in paramedic school that they might not grasp fully yet.
Well, that's perfect, man. You know what? Because I mean, I actually, last weekend I was on there on the Cascades and I had one of my buddies I was paddling with. Me and you actually took your first time down the Cascades, right?
Yes. Yeah. Peter Lapp.
Hey, we made it down and everybody was okay.
It was fun.
Yeah, but one of the things I think I had talked to you about, my buddy Alex dislocated his shoulder on the lead-in to Big Kahuna. He had flipped. I'll go ahead and kind of tell the story from my hand because I released a video and obviously the video's edited. And I spent more than one time trying to reset his shoulder. Or what do you call it? You call it reduction? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, it's a shoulder reduction.
Reduction, because someone's like, you can't say resetting. That's like saying, do you flip a kayak?
But I mean, I wouldn't say anything unless somebody's really pedantic. Then they might, say stuff about it. But
yeah. Who cares? And what happened was he actually flipped on the lead end to Kahuna Rapid. And I think he chalked his paddle on that shallow shelf coming in and it just popped out. And he actually rolled up, dropped over Kahuna, and then eddied out all with a hurt shoulder. And he started pointing at his arm. So another guy got him out real quick. And then I came up there on the bank and and this is where I wanted to talk to you about. One of the first things I did, I kind of like looked at him. I felt of his arm to see how it was. And it was like a big knot out. And this is probably the fourth, maybe fifth dislocated shoulder that I've witnessed personally with my own eyeballs. So this is not the first time I've seen this. And it was a big knot out. So it was dropped down and it was pointed up. I could feel it. So I asked him if he wanted to set it. And he said, yeah. I had him grab his knee and I had him leaning back like this and pulled his head back and he could not do it, man. He just sat there. He's pretty like built and he could not reset it himself. So then that's where I was like, I was out on a river. I can't even remember where I was at. And I watched someone one time lay a guy down on a rock. And I found out later that it was that, I think it's called Stetsman's technique. where you lay them down and then you pull it down like that slowly and it'll go back in. I tried it three times and could not get it to go. And eventually I just grabbed it behind the shoulder, the elbow and the wrist, and just kind of like went like that real quick and it popped right back in. And then he was like, oh wow, that's back. And I caught a lot of crap over that.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people were telling me they would never want me touching their shoulders or wanting me to do anything. It was like, you're not supposed to yank like that. That's bad. I could have done more damage than good. I'm like, wow. Okay. Well, you know, it was back
they
in.
They haven't seen a lot of shoulder reductions then.
And one thing I wanted to talk to someone like you that I consider you an expert. You're more of an expert than all these, you know, internet keyboard guys that are like guys or girls. I don't know who they are. And I wanted to ask you about, like, is there times where, because I watched a video one time of like a hockey player or a football player or something, and they had to put like a foot in that guy's armpit. There was like a nurse or it might've been a doctor or somebody. And they were like, ah, yanking, because this was like a big burly dude. This was not like a little frail skinny kid. And I don't know if that really, I was going to ask you, is that something that matters? Like, if it's like a bigger muscular guy, could it be harder than say someone like a 110 pound dude with like really bony shoulders? I'll let you take it away from there, man. I just wanted to build that scene for everybody and you, for everybody listening, and you kind of like, it wasn't just like jump him out, reach over and don't even feel, and just chunk, and then I left. That's what the video looked like, but go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, full disclosure, I'm no, you know, orthopedist. I'm not orthopedic doc. I'm not a shoulder reduction expert. I've reduced one dislocation on the golly. Got a video of that.
I've seen your video on that.
And I've participated, like I've assisted with doctors in reducing shoulders in the ER. And you are right. If they think that you were excessively rough with that person, they should like go to the OR and see them literally taking pretty much a sledgehammer and banging on the bones. I think theoretically, yeah, if someone has more muscle mass, then it would be harder to reduce, because the problem is those muscles spasm. Mm-hmm. But you know, an argument like in your favor is that the faster you reduce a dislocation, the better off that patient's or that person's going to be, because the longer you wait, the more those muscles spasm. So if you were to wait until they get to the ER, then it's going to be much more difficult for them to reduce that that shoulder. So I think, you know, pre-hospital shoulder reductions, there's a lot of literature looking at this. And even, you know, there's some literature, I think there was a study looking at raft guides reducing shoulders, and they had like a 94% success rate.
Wow.
So it's definitely feasible. And I think that it should be routinely taught amongst the paddling community.
Yeah. And I remember you said something on that. You mentioned something called the Cunningham technique, and that is something, I think that was what you did in your video. And will you go over the Cunningham technique, kind of like what that is?
Yeah. And, you know, I like the Cunningham technique because it's simpler. It requires less manipulation and it's just more straightforward. So as a paramedic, there is more liability for me to reduce a shoulder than there is for like just your everyday paddler. Because if I reduce a shoulder and, you know, someone wants to sue me or whatever, I have a higher liability than you would, because, you know, you're generally covered under like, you know, Good Samaritan laws and stuff like that.
Okay. That's actually a good point you have right there. So let me get this straight. You being a trained paramedic, you actually, if you like really screw their shoulder up or something, you could actually be held liable for like medical bills and all that, potentially. You know, it's rare, but I know it does happen, correct?
Yeah, potentially. And listen, here's the strange thing is I posted that video of me reducing a shoulder. Mm-hmm. And then somebody's like, oh, technically that's not in your scope of practice. And it's like, well, you know, so scope of practice is typically, so we're kind of governed by, we have a medical director, so a local physician who's in charge of what we can and can't do. And then we have a state board. Yeah, technically it's not within my scope of practice. And I received a message, someone saying, well, you could get a visit by the investigator. And my response was,
that
like,
sounds scary.
Tell him to bring it. You know what
who's
I mean?
The, like, who's the investigator, by the way?
Somebody from the state board. Yeah, yeah. So I'm like,
over over that YouTube video.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't give a shit, and I would do it again if I had to. And that's
I would want you to. Yeah,
yeah. Like, it's the safest way to get off of a river. Would you want someone with a dislocated shoulder trying to make it down the river in a kayak or a raft,
or even hiking out? Even hiking out, reset my shoulder. And if I can hike out, I'll just hike out. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I got off track a little bit, but, yeah, cunning, the technique we were talking about.
If you hold on, I'll pull it up real quick. I actually have it up. I'm going to let, we'll let it play out here. Is that on your screen?
Yeah, it is now.
Now lay your inside hand on their elbow.
Is this correct so far, what you're seeing on the screen?
Yep.
Because
so we'll pause it there. For everyone listening that can't see what's online, what's going on is let's say the person with the dislocated shoulder is reaching out and putting their palm on the shoulder of you, and then you're like clasping your arm over their elbow. Is that right? Does it all look good to you, Floyd, that you're thinking of?
Yeah, so there's different ways to do it. You can do it the way they did in that video of having them put their hand on your shoulder, or you can have them put their hand on your forearm. And the goal is just to provide the gentle, gradual downward traction. So just gentle traction down towards the ground.
Make your job impossible.
Okay. Yeah, and what I'm
reminding the patient to sit up straight.
We'll go ahead and mute it there because I want to hear what you have to say. What's he doing right here with his hand? What do you think's going on there?
So with this procedure, you're massaging different muscles. So it's technically like a pectoral deltoid massage. So you're going to like massage the pec, the delt, and you can even massage the bicep. The whole goal is to get those muscles to relax. And it also helps if you can reassure the person, just have them to calm down and relax, because the more they tense up and the more anxious they are, the more difficult it will be to reduce.
Yeah. And when you messaged me and you told me about like the first thing that you do is that Cunningham technique, I had actually never heard of that. So I had to look it up, and I see that how they placed the hand right there. And it actually was kind of from your video, but I think you're right. You had the guy put his hand on your forearm, correct? In your video?
I don't remember exactly. Forearm or shoulder. I mean, they teach it both ways.
Yeah. And would you say that's the kind of go-to method to do it?
So when I took an advanced wilderness life support class, that was the one they recommended, just because, you know, honestly, I'm not manipulating anything. I am literally, they're putting their arm on my shoulder and I'm resting my hand like on their elbow, kind of, and I'm just massaging them. And hey, if the shoulder pops in, it pops back in, right? I'm not manipulating anything.
So that's a good point.
It's the least invasive way to reduce a shoulder.
Because what you're saying is you're actually loosening all of those spasmed up muscles to loosen it up where it drops in on its own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there's a benefit, right? So this maneuver might not be effective if it's been dislocated for a while and those muscles have been spasming for a while. But if we're right on top of them when it happens, then, I mean, you saw my video, it popped in almost immediately. I didn't have to do almost anything. Some would say it's luck. Maybe it is, but it worked.
Yeah. And that's one thing that I had seen was people just lift their arm up and it goes back in. And then I see people doing that method of like on their knee and it just popping back in. But I was at the point where I thought that his shoulder was not going back in properly. And that's why I kind of put a little more umph behind it. But, you know, he was fine. He went to, got x-rays. He went and got an MRI and waiting for the results on the MRI, but everything looks really good. And I think he'll be back on the water in a couple of weeks.
And honestly, like, think about it this way. If you help reduce a shoulder and they do injure something, well, like, it could be that the initial insult, the initial injury called those tears or injuries.
Oh, the initial.
Rather than you helping to reduce the shoulder, like, there's just no way of knowing. And chances are that the initial dislocation caused the most damage.
Yeah, like chalking your paddle, and that could pull a lot of ligaments out of place just by chalking your paddle on a rock, not necessarily pulling it, right? That's what you're saying?
Yeah. And posture is huge. And I'm bad about, like, good paddling posture, especially when I'm bracing, because sometimes I'll put my paddle pretty far behind me when I'm bracing, you know, and I know better.
That actually, on that, you know, years ago, I would say years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, I've always had pretty good shoulders. I work my shoulders out a lot. I do a lot of, like, exercises for shoulder rotation. I've never had any shoulder issues, but I have had them tweaked and stuff. So, man, what I started doing, I had tweaked, like, my left shoulder. I think I had tweaked my left shoulder pretty bad. So, you know what I started doing? When I was eddying out, I started doing something, a cross bow. So I started cross bowing over there to kind of keep from using this. Like, when when we're eddying out, we drop in. I didn't like having that pull pressure on there. So I would go into eddies and cross bow, and I just started doing it. And then when my shoulder got better, I started doing over it. That's how I kind of started cross bowing so much, was really to kind of, like, rest this left shoulder. I would go into eddies like that, instead of going in like that, because that pressure of that blade was like, ah, but I still wanted to paddle. You know, obviously I probably should have been taking time off, but hey, let's just do a cross bow and we're fine.
Well, I've been practicing cross bows, and my friends are all like, is that Wade Harrison?
Cross bow was around in, like, 1984. Come on, guys. You know, they were using them in slalom in the 70s and fiberglass boats. No, I think the cross bow that he reaches real high around or whatever. I don't know what it was, but that's, yeah, I'm the only one that just does them the most on YouTube. I get it.
That's funny.
Yeah, man. On back, you know, that was a little sidebar, but back onto the shoulders. There was one other thing that I wanted to ask you about. Is there a time where you shouldn't reduce a shoulder? Like, when would you say, oh, don't mess with this? Like, what would you say, how, like, maybe the fingers didn't work right, or it was an impact off of, like, a 25 footer onto a rock? What would you say would be like, oh, let's not try to reset this shoulder at all?
One of the golden rules is that, like, if there's a fracture in that same extremity, then you kind of don't want to manipulate it. So if it's more than just a dislocation, and maybe they have, like, a humerus fracture, you wouldn't want to manipulate that.
Does How
that
would make I know? Sense?
Generally there will be a bulge or, like, lower, and shoulder dislocations have a pretty characteristic appearance when you look at them, like, they're squared off instead of the normal rounded curvature. So it's pretty obvious, and chances are that if you have that appearance, that it is a shoulder dislocation. Yeah, like, so if they go to the ER and the ER physician has a hard time resetting certain dislocations, or there's certain high-risk dislocations, like lower joint, like knee dislocations, are especially worrisome because of the vascular blood supply and stuff like that. And if you mess it up, you could really mess stuff up. But something that people might be interested in, just a general rule of thumb, if you've got someone with a fracture and they have compromised, like you mentioned, feeling for a pulse, and they have, let's say you're in a pretty remote area and helps, you know, hours away, and they have an angulated extremity where the fracture is obvious, but they have poor perfusion in their hands, so, like, their hands are turning white or blue, or you can't feel, like, a pulse down here.
Would they be real cold, or, like,
yep,
So you would feel that, would it be numb or tingly? What would you ask them?
Yeah, they will feel numbness and tingling. We call that like paresthesia. But yeah, they'll be like, it's numb. It'll be cold to the touch. It'll be pretty obvious that they have like a disruption in the circulation to that extremity. But actually what you would want to do is gentle realignment of that. So like, you know, especially if help is hours away, you mm-hmm. want to make that limb look like it normally should. And that's something that they should teach in like a general basic first aid type of class. If you're not sure, if it's not an obvious dislocation, then I probably would not reset that. But like you were saying, if you came off a drop and you hit something based on that mechanism, if you like fell.
Portaging or something, we slipped and fell.
Yeah. Then I would be less likely to want to reset that. But if like you were paddling, your paddle got stuck on something, or you were like, you know, reaching far behind you outside of your box, then that would clue me in that this deformity is a dislocation and not a fracture.
I lifted his PFD, and you're right. That's an excellent point. Mm-hmm. I pulled all the straps up. He's got a green vest. I opened the pocket up and I pushed his hand down inside the pocket, and he hiked up the bank with that as like a arm sling. Those PFDs are like one of the best arm slings you can have, right?
Absolutely.
Exactly. Yep. Well, man, that's awesome, Floyd. I don't want to bring you on here and talk for 2 hours on shoulders. One thing I wanted to also talk to you about, you posted a video not too long ago, and it was called the proper CPR on water type thing. Mm-hmm. I think you called it how to manage a drowning victim for whitewater kayakers.
Yep.
And for everybody that's listening that hasn't seen that, go over and check that out. Floyd has a YouTube channel, and that's one of the coolest videos out. You know, it is a little long. I get it, but you covered a wide range of things in there. You didn't just go straight into it, but it's worth a listening to. I watched the whole thing all the way through. I think it's like, 28 minutes long. So it's And I get you want to cover as much as you can. You did a good job on that. And I'll let you go ahead and take it. There was a couple of things in there that you really pointed out that I had never really thought of about chest compressions.
Yeah, let me give you the too long, didn't read version.
Okay, go ahead.
That doesn't want to sit through that. All right, so I got on this kick, well, this campaign, if you will, because I've seen a lot of misinformation out there. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to a lot of whitewater paddlers that said they've taken, you know, CPR classes, I've taken wilderness first aid classes, and they said, we no longer have to breathe for the person. And I'm like, that is unequivocally, like objectively, not even the case. I can take you to the American Heart Association where they say for drowning patients, it is ABC, meaning airway breathing circulation, not CAB, not compression airway breathing. All right. So the compression only stuff that you're taught, that's for the, you know, 50-year-old that's overweight, that eats McDonald's every day, and goes into cardiac arrest in the drive-through of McDonald's.
That's heart, like for compressions for heart attack victims, correct?
Yeah. So look at this. Let's say you have a heart attack, your heart goes into an abnormal rhythm. Okay. It's just quivering, and it's not pumping efficiently enough to circulate blood to the rest of your body. If you were to die suddenly right now, you have minutes before you run out of oxygen. All right. So the person, whoever's in your house, if they find you and they start doing CPR and they don't breathe for you, your blood is holding plenty of oxygen, and it's going to take time to burn through that, so to speak. Drowning patients, they have a severe oxygen deficit, meaning like you burn through all of your oxygen before your heart quits beating. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So like you can compress all day long, but if you have 0% oxygen, you can do CPR and circulating 0% of zero, or circulating 100% of zero is still zero.
Because there's no oxygen in the blood is what you're
exactly.
saying.
Exactly. That's I what drowned. Caused you to die.
Yeah, technically, yeah, I guess so.
It's an oxygen problem. It's a brain. It's not a primary heart problem. All right. So think about it like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Because one of the things that you mentioned in the video, you actually talked about like the hand of God technique. Even if you could just pull someone over and start chest, I almost needed a hand of God right there, my chair. But you said even pulling someone over and just starting an air, just blowing in their mouth mm-hmm. immediately would be better than trying to like get them out, start compressions and all that. Is that correct? You're saying get air to them immediately.
Like the quick provision of oxygen from your lungs to their lungs in the most feasible way possible. So if I'm in the water and I can't quickly get them out, like there's going to be some delay, I'm going to try to give them breaths there, because the Wilderness Medical Society, which is the authority on drowning, not the American Heart Association, they make their money off of those old, you know, patients with high cholesterol, not the young, healthy people like us. But they say that like you increase their likelihood of a good outcome by more than like a factor of three if you give breaths in the water as opposed to waiting until you get them to land. All right.
That's really good information there. Yeah.
Like if I'm stuck in a raging eddy and it's a high walled canyon and like I can't get you out, well, doing CPR in the water is not going to be effective, right? Because you're just going to be bouncing up and down in the water. So the only thing you can do really is get breaths. So if you're in that situation, just get some breaths in and then get them out.
Yeah. And one thing is a lot of times, I guess, yeah, just all that time it takes to get someone out of the water, move their vest over, start loosening everything up to try to get in the proper spot and all that. You're saying still kind of start doing that, but start giving breath immediately. When should you give compressions in? Are you saying you shouldn't even on drowning victims, you shouldn't even really worry about compressions?
No, you should, but it takes a back seat to breaths.
Okay.
So breath like, first. The New England Journal of Medicine, they have an article on drowning. They recommend five breaths first. Five breaths, because
okay,
like a few of them could be misfires. Just because you put your lips on someone else's and pinch their nose and open their mouth and breathe into them doesn't mean the air is going into the lungs and not the stomach. All right. So we give a few extra for good measure. All right. And another rationale on that is just because if I pull you out of the water and you're limp and you're not breathing, that doesn't necessarily mean that your heart's not beating, right?
Mm-hmm.
When your heart is deprived of oxygen, it is not able to pump as vigorously as it normally does. So it could just be that you're in severe shock and your blood isn't circulating enough to perfuse your brain to maintain consciousness.
Okay.
Does that still make sense?
But the heart is still beating.
Mm-hmm. It could just be extremely slow.
What happens when the lungs get water in it? It just closes up. Is that what happens?
Nope. So this is kind of interesting too.
Okay.
All right. Let me back up a little bit. Talk about the drowning process.
Okay.
All right. This might bother some people, and I should preface this by saying like, what I'm saying isn't meant to disparage anybody that has been in one of these rescue situations, okay? Because I understand I'm sitting here in my comfy chair with my house set to 67 degrees, all right? I was not in that situation.
I know.
Yeah. All right? So I don't want anybody to take this the wrong way, but as a medical professional, what we do is we provide constructive criticism, right? What went well? What could go better? What can we do better to help that person or the next person, the next victim? So I just wanted to say that, that I do understand stressful situations like that. I have made mistakes as a healthcare provider, all right? And I've had to have people tell me that I've done stuff wrong. But if we want to get better, we have to talk about stuff like this.
Yeah, that was the whole reason of bringing you on too. I mean, I wanted to learn more because no one person could, if they do, they're full of crap. Nobody's going to know everything about everything.
Absolutely.
That's just life in general. But that's why, you know, I wanted to reach out to like you and just talk a little bit about, I know that you're not like an expert on shoulders, but you know more than most. How about that? Than most people that I could usually reach out to. And, you know, I'd like to talk to an orthopedic and, you know, go into more like exercises and all that stuff too. But
sure. And I'd recommend that.
Maybe I could, maybe you know somebody.
I do. We've got a local ER doc. Also a paddler.
Well, there you go. That'd be a good one to talk to too. But watching your video on the on water CPR definitely kind of changed my mindset a little bit that I had never thought of. And now I know if someone drowns while I'm there, the first thing I'm going to do is start pulling them up and giving breaths just because of your videos. And that could possibly change everything, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And backing up, let me talk about the drowning process. So we used to think that the lungs fill with tons of water, right? But they actually don't. On autopsy, there's very little, if any, water in the lungs. Now, this really doesn't make sense, does it?
No.
So when you're underwater, the general process is like this. You hold your breath until you can't hold your breath anymore. And then, so at some point, you start swallowing water. So
not breathing it in, swallowing, like in your
swallowing, like I'm reflexively drinking. Yep. Okay. Yep. Like you're drinking it, reflexively swallowing the water. So most people can hold their breath for about 1 minute when you're stressed out.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably going to be left. At some point, you will aspirate some water, like it'll go down your windpipe and hit your vocal cords. But, you know, what happens if it goes around the pipe? You start coughing, right? So when you aspirate water, you start reflexively coughing. And at some point, your vocal cords automatically close on their own. So we call that laryngospasm. So they just spasm shut and nothing can get in. Now, from this period, you've been without oxygen for minutes, all right? So your heart rate's initially fast, like it's beating like out of your chest. And then as you become more deprived of oxygen, your heart rate slows significantly. And then, you know, usually if we witness somebody drowning, or maybe it's a flush drowning, so they're repeatedly bobbing up and down, this is kind of similar, right? You're going through multiple rapids, high volume river, stuff like that. But yeah, on autopsy, because of this reflexive coughing, the vocal cords spasming shut, they generally find very little water in the lungs. So these people are deprived of oxygen long before their heart actually quits beating. So it could be that if I were to pull somebody out of the rhythm, out of the river, that their heart could be beating very slowly and just, it could be very weak and I just can't feel a pulse, or their brain's not perfused well enough. But if I breathe for them, if I give a few breaths and I bring their oxygen levels up, that they could regain consciousness. But with what little water does enter the lungs, the picture that you're going to see is going to be far worse. All right.
The foam and the nastiness. I've seen videos and pictures. Yeah. Yeah. It's not pretty. Yeah.
And the foam is distracting because your lungs, especially your alveoli, it's like, think of grapes. They're like these little tiny grape-like sacs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the oxygen goes through. It goes through your airway passages to your alveoli, and they're very thin. So when water hits that, they will collapse.
Yeah.
Right. And also, these little sacs are coated in this covering called surfactant. It keeps them, something to do with surface tension. I'm not a physiologist or anything, but the surface tension keeps them from closing. Well, it's like a soapy substance. So when water hits that, what happens when water hits soap? What do you get? You get foam.
Bubbles up. Yeah, it just foams up.
You get bubbles, you get foam. So when you're breathing for them, all right, they could have a lot of foam coming up, and that could be a distraction. So the process is this: get them out of the water, and if as fast as possible. If you can't get them out quickly, breathe for them in the water, all right? But eventually, you're going to give those 5 breaths, then you're going to start CPR. When I start CPR, I'm not doing just CPR. I'm doing 30 compressions and then giving 2 breaths.
Okay.
So start with 5 breaths, 30 compressions, 2 breaths, and then you go 32, 32, 32, alternating back and forth.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so the lungs isn't full of water is what you're saying. You're saying it could only take a small amount, and when that goes into the lungs, it closes up. It's really like when I see people coughing up water, is it coming out of the lungs or stomach?
It's coming out. So if somebody coughs up water, like if they're coughing and they expel water, that is coming from the lungs, but because of the effects that the small amount of water has when it hits the lungs, it's causing it to look exponentially worse because you can get, we call it non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. I know that's a medical term, but so basically because of that water hitting the soapy stuff in your lungs, it can make large amounts of foam.
Okay. And that's what's causing that.
Foam
coming out of the lungs. I never really thought about it, I guess. So that's all that coating coming out with the water. And that's where the foam all over the face, you'll see it in the nose and face. It's not a pretty sight. I've seen it. It's not pretty. I get it.
And you can't do anything with it. You can try to like do abdominal thrust to try to get it out. It's not going to do anything.
Well, that's where the little small CPR mask comes in so handy, right? You can throw those little masks on the face. You have one handy right there?
I've got one somewhere deep in my bag. I make it very compact. Oh, actually, I've got it in my dry bag. Whoops.
That's something I've been meaning to order. I put a first aid kit together not too long ago, and I don't have a first aid. But that's something I would carry in the front of my vest because I want to be able to get to that immediate. You know, I'm talking about those little keychain ones. You know what I'm talking about? Yep. I would want that in my pocket in my vest because – I definitely would not want to have to go to my boat, pull my first aid kit. I'd want to unzip my pocket, pull that mask out, throw it down on the face. And really all it's for is to kind of like help get the breath down in there and not have to swallow that foam, correct?
Yeah, pretty much. It provides some barrier between you and the patient. But honestly, like if I see my friend, like come here, buddy.
If you're in the water, dude, and you've drowned, I'm not going to be like, hold on, let me get my mask. I'm just going to have you up and right away. I don't care. That's me too. Even if it's not my friend, you know, even if it's just somebody,
absolutely.
I couldn't imagine taking that one little second of trying to find my mask and like, let me get this folded out real nice and neat. You know, I get it. I get it though. I get what their use is, but me personally, that wouldn't really bother me that much. I would be so hyped up on adrenaline that of trying to save you that I'm not going to be really thinking. I'm worried about like getting the perfect little mask lined up on your face.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a role for a mask, right? Like I can get a good seal with it around your nose and your mouth.
The
so I can like
paramedic mask.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, the one you, yeah. When I was researching them, there's one that goes all around, like you said, like that. And that was a different one. I was talking about the little keychain one that you fold out. And it's just a little pipe that goes down.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I carry this one. And I actually carry, they call it a pocket BVM, which is much bigger and nothing that you could carry in your vest. But it's an actual bag that collapses and expands, and I can squeeze it instead of having to breathe for you through my mouth. I like hold it over your face and I squeeze this bag.
I've seen those in the back of ambulances.
They put that on
like a person's mouth and then they're like, that's what you're, what's it called?
On Amazon, it's called, a pocket BVM, if you want to pull that up.
That'd be something to look at. The Pocket BVM.
Yeah, let me make sure that's what it's called.
That is it. That, yep. I could probably.
No, it, yeah, that's what it is.
Can you see that?
Yeah, yep, that's it. It collapses down, and that's not really a small container. It's hard to tell from the picture. It takes up a little bit of space, and I take that along if I'm on like a pretty long trip and a
room. Well, that thing's not cheap, $48.
Yeah, but
it's a smaller version of that thing that I've seen on like amulets and stuff.
Yeah, it is. It just collapses down much better.
Hmm.
It requires, it's a different technique for use. It's a little more difficult to use, but you know, if you get one and we're on the side of the river together, I'll show you how to use it.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to see this thing. Yeah. Yeah. Well, man, anything else you got on CPR or anything like that? I think we covered a majority of it. Yeah. You definitely had some good stuff on the process of drowning. And number one, the 5 breaths right away, mm-hmm. then the chest compressions, 30, then 2, and then start going through your chest breath and all that, right?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, 30 compressions, 2 breaths after those 5 initial. You know what? If somebody says, hey, my CPR instructor told me that I don't need to do that, then they're wrong. Okay, I've got like all the references. Give them my contact information. I would be happy to.
Did you put the references in that video?
I think so.
Yeah, you should. You don't, but if you, I mean, you could put some links in your description.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
But you did cover it in the video. I watched the video, and you kind of covered a lot of those links and all that. If someone just goes look up, you know, how to manage a drowning victim for whitewater kayakers by Floyd Miracle, look that video up and they can kind of like go through and see what you're talking about.
Yeah. Let me show you something else that's cool. I have something I wanted to show you, just a FYI. I had watched your video on what you carry in your first aid bag.
Okay.
I wanted to show you something really cool. Like if someone has a life-threatening like arterial bleed from their extremity, so their arm or their leg,
like inside like the major artery,
I mean just arterial, like red blood spurting out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you put pressure on that and you can't get it to stop, right?
Okay.
And you would generally put a tourniquet on, right?
Yeah.
So they have these cool tourniquets called the SWAT-T, which stand for stretch, wrap, and tuck, and those are on Amazon as well.
Uh-huh.
And if you look, it's like this little orange thing and it expands really long, and I'm showing everybody in the video, but what you do is like you make one pass with it, and each time that you wrap it around the extremity, you stretch it tighter, and with each successive wrap, it gets tighter and tighter until it occludes all the blood flow distally. So if you
hold it back up again, let me see that. So what, for everybody listening, what he's holding, it looks like about what? That's about 6 inches wide. It's like a big rubber band, correct?
Yep.
How long is it? About 3 foot? That looks about 36 inches maybe?
Yeah, it's pretty long. This thing is versatile now. Like it functions as a tourniquet, and it would take some practice to be able to apply this.
What's the name again? Give me that name again.
SWATT. These things are cool because they're very compact. They're relatively cheap compared to like the tourniquets we carry on the ambulance, the CAT tourniquets, but this has multiple purposes. So I can use this as like, let me show you, as like a sling if I wanted to.
Yeah, it looks awesome.
I could use it as a sling. I could use it as just a pressure bandage. So if I wanted to like put some gauze on a bleeding wound, I could use this to wrap around that. There are just multiple purposes for this one device. And I think it's perfect for like remote adventurers who want to go light.
Yeah.
You can even cut it into like little pieces, use it for like little different things.
It's a genius thing. I like it. Yeah. No, I'm going to pick up one of those, a SWAT tourniquet, huh?
Yeah. SWAT T. So pretty cool little device. It's nothing I would like carry on an ambulance just because it takes time to apply, but it, you know, the other tourniquets that we carry, I'm not sure how they do being wet all the time and stuff. Like with a tourniquet, if you are trying to actually place a tourniquet, you want full occlusion. I'm not trying to place it just a little tight. I want that sucker tight to where I don't have a pulse in that extremity, because I don't want to get into too much detail, but you can cause compartment syndrome. So if I put it just a little tight to where the arterial blood is coming down, right? But the venous blood, the return is occluded. So I've got blood going in, but not out. And that increases the pressure in that limb, and it can create what we call compartment syndrome. All right. So I want it to completely occlude that. Now, like using rope, using a belt, using like webbing, that can be an effective tourniquet, but like from the literature we have based on like civilian injuries and people using like homemade non-commercial tourniquets, they're just more likely to fail, not as effective. That's why I wanted to pitch this to everybody.
Yeah.
And they're not giving me any money. I just carry one in my bag and thought everybody else might be interested.
I'll try to share it here for everybody that wants to see it. And for everybody listening, can you see that, Floyd?
Yep.
This is it, correct?
That's it.
Yeah, and it's $19 on Amazon. I'll leave a link in the description where you can get these up. I like the looks of it. Man, and that's super compact. Yeah, you're right. This thing has a lot of different uses.
Yeah, I don't carry a whole lot in my first aid kit, but if you're not breathing, I got you. If you have life-threatening bleeding, I will stop it. All right.
Well, so there you go.
I got that covered.
Well, that's all I need. And, you know, I always like people when I'm paddling with a group of people. I don't care how much like certificates or whatever you have. I like to know that the person, when the shit's going down, they stay level-headed. They've been there. And they can take care of me when I'm in trouble. And that's kind of like what I kind of pride myself on. I'm like, stay calm. I assess the situation properly and I try to go from there. And I'm like, I don't really get very panicky. And it's like, I want somebody when they're with me that will jump on it right away and just take over the scene, not sit there and look around. You know how it is. You probably see where somebody's waiting for somebody else to do something. Well, yep. You're going to help them. Where's Floyd? Floyd, will you come help? I'm like, no, let's just go.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you just got to get stuff done. You know what I mean?
Yeah. All right, man. Well, yeah. Moving on from that, is there anything else? Anything else as far as like wilderness paramedic stuff or CPR or anything like that that you want to bring up?
I don't think so. I would encourage folks to take some kind of course. You know what I mean?
I would too.
Take a wilderness first responder, first aid class. Hey, EMT paramedic, we need folks in our profession. You get your EMT license in like, 6 months, come work on an ambulance. And
you can travel anywhere, right? Anywhere in the world with that. You could be
they desperately need people. So the job market's like, it's there.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So on to paddling, what kind of boat are you paddling right now?
Medium code.
Wow. How long you had that code?
For probably 5-6 months now.
What did you have before that? Didn't you have an Antix or something?
Well, I've got an Antix 1.0, but my creek boat was a Newmad.
Newmad.
And I think I outgrew it, or my skills kind of outgrew it. I wanted something just a little more edgy, but I love the stability of the Newmad. Like, it took care of me. But I wanted something a little more sporty, easier to make some moves, like mid rapid and with more rocker. And I went out on a limb. I talked to you about it, actually. You
recommended the code. I remember that.
And I just bit the bullet, bought one. Like, first time I got in it, took it on Lower Big Sandy. And, man, that thing took care of me. Like, I loved it.
Yeah.
Like, I felt right at home in that code. And I'll be at Tallulah this weekend.
Yeah. When your skills are progressing and you're paddling harder stuff, like, say, the, you know, the Lower Big Sandy or something like that, you don't want to take a small river runner or playboat down that kind of stuff. You need a boat to kind of blast through things. And your skill level was getting to the point where you could use a boat like the Code. And because I paddle the Code too. And I mean, I really like the Code. And I think it's a great boat from beginner to expert. And, you know, there's a big thing on, you know, beginner boats. What kind of good beginner boats do you want to be in? More of a edgy type river runner, or do you want to be in something that'll take care of you? I'm 50-50 on that, man. I'm right now, I'm 50-50, whether I prefer someone start in a Jackson Z3 or a Dagger Code, or start in, say, like a Remix or a Party Brap or a, you know, Wave Sport Diesel, or maybe an Antix, you know, start in something like that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Listen, I don't know what the right progression is, but I know what I like and what I'm comfortable with. When I started, I've only been boating for just over 2 years now.
Yeah.
And everybody said, you don't want this, you don't want that. And the things I liked was everything that people said I shouldn't get. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I've learned to just kind of, I like what I like. It's working out for me. I'm doing pretty good. You know, I've got a good group of paddling friends that one guy that I routinely paddle with is a hand paddler and wears like a lacrosse helmet.
Oh yeah.
So you know what I
Even
mean?
Even better. Like, hand paddler with the shield.
Yeah.
I love it. Love it.
So I mean, like, whatever boat I'm in, everybody's always looking at him anyway. So
yeah,
I
don't have to worry.
Laugh at that.
Yeah. And one thing I did notice, I seen you and you have a hardcore, is it a hardcore mango?
Yeah, it's the one, it's not the cedar shaft one. I actually broke that the first time that I was using it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to hear your opinion on those. I've had mixed opinions on those hardcore paddles. They're supposed to be wood with overlaid carbon fiber. Mm-hmm. Yours is not that.
No, the first one I got was a cedar shaft. And then the second one they sent me, because they said I was particularly hard on paddles, was with the overlaid carbon shaft. And I love it. So I started with an AT, and maybe I'm just a creature of habit, but I loved how it felt my hands. I use bent shaft, and I just really got accustomed to that feel.
That oval, it's that oval egg shape in the AT.
I guess.
Yeah.
And then once I tried going to Werner, and it just fell off. So I was looking for that same feel, and I just tried hardcore, and it felt like I was holding an AT. And I loved it. And, you know, I mean, the it's super stiff. Like, if you hit a rock with it, it's tink, you know, like it's stiff, but it's responsive. Like, when you plant it and you, like, really try to throw some power down, it'll go.
Yeah.
Right? Probably not good for creaking with a lot of rocks, but, I mean, I use it for almost all applications, but, you know.
Yeah. It works.
But I love
it. Yeah, I just wanted your quick opinion of the hardcore paddle. I'm trying to get my hands on some of them, so, or at least one of them, the Mango. I have used it. I just like to do an official review of it at some point. And maybe if we paddle together, we could like swap paddles for a lap or something.
That'd be cool. And the guys, I don't remember their name, but they're out of like Washington State. Super responsive, super friendly. Like, I broke my first one, so I had flipped and my paddle got pinned, and I guess I was underwater hanging on to my paddle like this, and then it just, I felt this crack, and then
wasn't your shoulder.
Yeah I probably shouldn't have done that, but I only had like half of my paddle, and Anyway, I told the guy I was devastated. First time using the paddle. I guess that's how it always works, right? You get a brand new paddle and you break it. He was super understanding. He's like, I've never had this happen. Like, are you just, what were you doing with this thing?
I was trying to pry a car up. You know, I told him, normal stuff. You know what?
Like, he sent me another one. He's like, but I'm not sending you this cedar shaft one. You're getting the carbon.
Wow, that's awesome. He took care of you, though. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, all right, Floyd, man. You know, we're going on over an hour here. I think we covered about everything I wanted to talk about. Is there anything you wanted to talk about? Anything else?
No. Going back to the shoulder thing, I just want everybody to know I'm not an expert on shoulders. So if I said something incorrectly, whatever, I do it all the time. I won't own up to my mistakes, but
yeah, good enough.
But it should be accurate. All right.
Yeah. And for everybody listening on Spotify or iTunes, you know, go over and check out Floyd Maracle's YouTube channel. He has a YouTube channel. He's been posting his paddling adventures. And
I mean, my friends like it. So,
well, that's all that matters. As long as you like it and your friends like it. I'm like, okay, good enough for me. All right, Floyd, man, I'll let you get off here, buddy, and get back to it. But I appreciate you coming on. And yeah, thanks a lot.
Awesome. Pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. All right, we'll see you, man. Let me shut this off.